I know some of you are leaving early this afternoon, so can you please make sure you send back your reimbursements and your receipts? The sooner you send them back, the sooner we can reimburse you. But no receipts, no reimbursement. Over here on the corner of this desk, Sheila has a list of the meeting participants and their contact information. Grab one of those as you go or sometime this afternoon. Otto, it's all yours. Thank you.
Let's see. Am I on? Okay, we're going to talk a little bit about the relevance of the Beagle data to humans. And of course, we've done all this work with beagles, not because we want to find out what's going to happen to beagles with radionuclides, but rather we want to be able to predict the risk to people. So here's the star of our show, I think maybe the first appearance today. But we really want to talk about what the risks are to people. And the key to this connection are the radium dial painters and the other people who were exposed to radium in the 20th century and are part of the U.S. radium cases. When I first saw the data from the radium cases, Bob Evans gave a seminar back in the 70s. It looked like a complete mess, looks like a scatterplot plot. I thought, that's really strange. Doesn't make any sense. You got points everywhere. And I realized the reason it had points everywhere is that it was plotted as a function of cumulative dose. And the phenomenon that we were observing is not a function of cumulative dose, it's a function of dose rate. The other problem was that the plot had points for radium-226 exposed people and also for radium-228 exposed people. Turns out that radium-228 is about 3 times more effective per unit of dose in producing bone sarcoma. So you have to get those out. So what I did was I separated out those individuals who are mostly exposed to radium-226, took out all the radium-228 cases, and replotted it as a function of dose rate. And this is the plot I got for the Davis beagles, and this is for the humans. I actually published this plot in Science magazine 30 years ago. And I thought it was going to change everybody's attitude towards what was happening, because it seems like such a clear picture here. Here are the beagles, here are the people, and here are Miriam Finkel's mouse data from Argonne. As a function of average dose rate to the skeleton, time to death, and the relationship of the three plots is clearly related to the lifespan. In fact, it's related to the lifespan in such a way that it's clear that it's at any given dose rate, it's taking about the same number of cell divisions to get to the place where the cancers occur for each of the species. So I replotted the data with the time axis non-dimensionalized as a function of percent of lifespan. I made it here as millilifespan fraction. So 1,000 millilifespan, I guess, is a whole lifespan. And when I replotted it that way, all the data for the three species fall basically on the same line. And the slope, it's a power function with a slope of -1/3. And the reason it's -1/3 is very consistent for all the alpha emitters. It always comes out 1/3. I fit every alpha emitter that I could find. It always comes out 1/3. It's proportional to the distance between the radiative events, whatever they are, double strand breaks or the radiation emissions. It's proportional to distance. Now, when you know this relationship here, you can take data from another species and estimate the risk to people by lifespan normalization, as long as you work with average dose rate to the skeleton and think about the normalization of the lifespan. So for example, you could take Miriam Finkel's mouse data from way back when and predict pretty well the risk to people. You could do it a lot better with the Beagle data from Davis. The Beagle data from Davis has really grouped quite well. And here's what's going on in the three dimensions. First dimension is average dose rate to the skeleton. The next dimension is time to death. And finally, the third dimension is the position or frequency of appearance of different cases. And on the far right, we have those cases which are radiation injury, these very high doses. These are the doses Marv Goldman always called the incandescent doses, right, Marv? So these dogs got overdosed. Then you get all the bone cancer cases, bone sarcoma cases here. And eventually you get to the lifespan of the animal. And for that group that has a dose rate such that the line is way above, you get a virtual threshold because those dogs never live long enough to develop the bone cancer. They would have if they changed their lifespan. They would have. Now, a couple of things about this. First of all, this is a log-normal distribution with a geometric standard deviation of only 1.22. You know, at Loveless, we call that monodisperse, right? Yeah. Less than 1.25. And how many biological studies have you ever done where you get a coefficient of variation so small? Maybe 25%. It's remarkable. So what's happening here is that as the dog's living its life at a given dose rate, average dose rate, when it gets to the line, it's going to get the bone cancer. Matter of fact, we got the first cancer, amputated the limb, have another one several months later. And we have some dogs that have as many as 4 or 5 sarcomas develop. When they get to the line, they don't make it beyond. Pretty sharp cutoff. The other thing about it is that the cumulative dose is a very poor indicator of what's going on. Because while the dose rate tells you exactly what's going to happen, once you know the function, the cumulative dose doesn't. For example, if you look at this point here, at 1/10 of a gray per day, it takes about 1,200 days. That would make it 120 gray to cause bone cancer in beagles at that dose rate. You come over here to 0.03, there we are. It's about 4,000 days. It only takes 0.03, you have times 10 to the minus 3 times 4,000. So because it takes 12. So it took 120 gray here. But it only takes 12 gray to do it at this lower dose rate. So now if you start plotting things in terms of cumulative dose, it's a scatter plot. You get a mess. So the cumulative dose doesn't really tell you. If I tell you the cumulative dose, you can't tell me the risk. But you can come out here and you can estimate what I call a virtual threshold by saying, well, if I get, you know, 3 or 4 standard deviations away from this line and see where it intersects the lifespan, then in that case, it's going to be a very low incidence. 3 standard deviations, bet 1 in 1,000. If you want to go to 1 in 10,000 or whatever, you could do it. You can always make that calculation. Now, this is actually a three-dimensional plot, and people ask me about this and say, I don't understand this three-dimension thing. But the three dimensions are all here. First, we have the average dose rate to the skeleton, the alpha dose rate to the skeleton. Here, we have the time to death. The third dimension is the grouping. If those were little BBs piled up, you'd have a hill of them. That's the third dimension, the grouping. So I can plot that in three dimensions. Here's what it looks like. The dose rate to the in gray per day, the time to death. And then if you look out at the highest dose rates, you've got the radiation injury deaths. At the intermediate dose rates, you have the bone cancer deaths. And then at the low dose rates, the natural lifespan. This is the Gompertzian natural lifespan. This is for the beagles at Davis with the intake at 435. Now, if you look at the risk of dying, and that's what this is, the risk of dying, again, dose rate to the skeleton, time to death. Everybody in the colony died. So they all made it to the top where the risk was 100%. The only difference is some of them died earlier because of radiation injury, and some died earlier because of bone cancer, and some died because of natural lifespan causes of death. In our colony, about nearly half the controls died of cancer, and the other half died of degenerative diseases associated with aging. And then a few, you know, there were a few that one got strangled and so forth, but about 50% each way. They didn't get poisoned by the neighbors or run over by a car. They got, you know, fantastic veterinary medical care. Now we can break this up into its component parts. So we have the, looking just at the injury deaths, they all occur out there at this high dose rate. At the very low dose rates, you have just the natural lifespan. And so here's the plot of the bone cancers. It's a, sort of a mountain coming out of this Euclidean plain. And so there's where they all, how they all go together. You put these three together, and you get the total deaths. And they are the three separate parts. And from this plot, and from the calculations that go along with it, you can calculate the risk at any dose rate. Okay, the next step is to try to predict the human risk. And so using this principle of lifespan normalization, I normalize both the injury and the cancer risk to predict the human data. Now, the human data are plotted here, but I did not use any of those data to create this plot. The plot was completely created mathematically by lifespan normalization of the Davis-Spiegel study for both the injury deaths and the sarcoma deaths. And you can see it's pretty good. Now, these points are a lot more scattered around this line. We had only about 25% coefficient of variation here for the data in our beagles. But our dosimetry was a lot better than the human dosimetry. The human dosimetry was really difficult. First of all, when we were doing dosimetry on these beagles, we were counting them every 6 months in a whole body counter. And we knew the dose rate every 6 months exactly. It's only the dose rate that we measured, by the way. So we did that throughout their lives, so we know that pretty well. And the only thing we're missing is the bone skeleton weight. And we did there were separate studies done. I think Marv was involved in doing these separate studies to find out what the bone weight was as a fraction of the young adult weight, body weight. So we had a way of just taking the young adult body weight and figuring out approximately, quite well actually, within about 6%, what the bone skeleton, total skeletal weight was for the bone, the marrow-free bone, because this is all the doses being delivered to the bone itself, not to the marrow. So we could get these doses quite nicely. But in the case of the humans, first of all, they didn't even make any, they just said, oh, if it's a woman, 5,000 gram skeleton, if it's a man, it's 7,000. Let it go with that. Didn't make any difference to the stature or the size of the person. On the other hand, they had to look at people sometimes after they were dead, try to figure out from measurements of radium and certain bones whether they could figure out what the original intake was. So the dosimetry for the U.S. radium cases is a lot more scattered, and that's why the points vary quite a bit more around the line.
Roughly, how many cases are up there in the human?
Right? Beg your pardon?
How many human cases are in that data plot, roughly?
I don't remember, Roger, but it looks like about 30. Now, what I did was I was very careful to go through, and they had picked only cases where 75% or more of the dose was from the radium-226. And because there were about 1,700 people in the whole study and several hundred cancers. As I say, the difference between radium-228 and 226 is marked. So if you put them all together, it makes a kind of a mess out of it. I haven't got it with me today, but I did the radium-228 by itself. And that's a nice separate story.
Yeah.
Now, actually, in the people, unlike the beagles, one other thing was happening. The radium-226 decays to radon, and some of it comes out of the bone. Quite a bit of it comes out of the bone. It's distributed around the body, and it's trapped in the human in the sinuses of the head. Beagles have better noses than people, by the way. So they don't have this problem. So we didn't have any head carcinomas with beagles. But with people, with the radium-226, not the radium-228, but the radium-226, the radon has a 3.8-day half-life. It can come out of the bone, diffuse into blood, and some of it gets trapped in the nasal sinuses and so forth, and the mastoid region of the head. And over a period of time, the alpha radiation of that tissue leads to carcinoma, head carcinoma. And there's quite a few of those. So I broke these two up for display purposes into the two parts. Here are the data, and then I put the carcinomas up here. They were on the previous slide also. And separated the two functions based upon the ratios of the number of cases. And then I could plot the whole thing together in one three-dimensional plot. Dose rate, gray per day to the skeleton, time to death in years. And this is the probability density function here, frequency. So you can see at the very highest dose rates, we have the radiation injury deaths, and there were those. Then at intermediate dose rates, we have the bone cancer and head cancer deaths. And then at the low dose rates, natural lifespan. And so we could break this into look at its total risk of these four things. And again, the chance of dying always reaches 100% at some point, but for the radiation injury deaths, it's quite early, and then for the other two, it's later. And finally, the ones that live the longest are the ones that live a natural lifespan. So here's the occurrence of deaths from skeletal radium-226 in people from injury to the bone and the marrow. Here's the natural lifespan deaths, the human head cancer deaths, and the human bone cancer deaths. Now, many years ago, Robley Evans looked at these data in two dimensions in terms of cumulative dose, and he said, well, there's a threshold. And this is the plot that he plotted, so it's back from 1972. And what he's looking at is this very same information that I've got here in three dimensions, but this is a two-dimensional view of it. Also, he didn't have all the data in 1972 that we have now. So he reached the conclusion that there was a threshold, and in fact, he wrote one paper in 1974 that proved that you couldn't statistically fit any linear model to these data. So this analysis agrees quite well with what his earlier observations. And at low dose rate, you would expect very few cases. And that's the whole picture together. So here's your whole risk of dying here, and the injury deaths, and bone cancer deaths, bone sarcoma, and your head carcinoma. So you had both sarcoma and carcinoma, both fitting into this model. And then, of course, natural lifespan. Now, quite a few years ago, I had a chance to work with Jim Park, and we were working on these data from the studies here at PNL on plutonium, 239 oxide inhalation. And there were two studies done. The first one was done, and the doses were quite high, and they had a lot of deaths from actual respiratory insufficiency and injury to the lung. And they didn't get too low, so they did another study, study number two. These were both studies of inhaled plutonium dioxide, plutonium-239 dioxide. And again, I plotted as the average dose rate to the scale to the lung and as time to death. Now, the first remarkable thing is that to see the precision of the work that was done at PNL on these studies, these data overlay perfectly. And they were done years apart. So it's just a fantastic job of doing these studies. The care that was done in actually generating the aerosols and doing the dosimetry and figuring out the dose over the lifespan, the whole deal. Because you can see these two studies just overlay perfectly, and they fit together, you know, like hand in a glove. And so they tell you the whole story. There were controls with lung cancer. And there were some cases of lung cancer down here. I fit those cases of lung cancer. In this case, the geometric standard deviation was 1.21. Again, this line and the actual cases are monodispersed around the line. And again, the minus one-third comes up every time for alpha. I'm not going to be talking about it today, but for beta, it comes up two-thirds. This means it takes two beta particles to cause whatever damage one alpha is doing, maybe a double strand break or something like that. Comes out exactly two-thirds every time for the betas. okay, next step. We want to scale this to people. I got this term scaling from Leon Rosenblatt many, many years ago. Everybody was calling it extrapolation. You know, this is human extrapolation. And it's not extrapolation. This is a scaling process because it involves all these different factors that are being put together. In this case, we're going to do it by lifespan normalization. And I also looked at some data that was done at PNL by Chuck Sanders on rats. And we had those rat data. At that time, we couldn't find any human data, probably for good reason. Our standards were too good. So I took the beagle data and scaled it to rat life and to people life. And there are the Chuck Sanders data. I did not use those data to produce this plot. The plot just comes out. You just scale it by lifespan for the rat. So I scaled by lifespan for people from the beagle again and made this prediction. And at least in the plutonium work in the United States, I couldn't find any cases I could put in there. Maybe the Russians will provide the data. So in three dimensions, you've got the lung injury at the high dose rates to the lung, intermediate lung cancer, lung carcinoma, and at low dose rates, natural lifespan. So you have the three parts again. Deaths from lung injury, natural lifespan, and then this is what the risk of dying of lung cancer looks like for the beagles. I replotted that in terms of initial lung burden, and you can do this with all of these three-dimensional plots. It's not as precise, but you can go back and look at the initial lung burden, and you get the same story, but the sigma G's are a little bigger, a little bit more scatter. By working with the actual average dose rate, which is for each dog, an individual, there's less variability than just taking the initial lung burden, because over the lifetime of two dogs that have the same initial lung burden, the actual doses are going to be different somewhat. But I did it this way because it's easier to look at, and you can see here that here's your risk of developing lung cancer predicted by this method for a person at age 20. I did this for different ages too. And down here at the beginning point, we have 1 kilobecquerel, which is 27 nanocuries. So that's almost 2 times the old maximum permissible lung burden. So the old maximum permissible lung burden was down here somewhere. So it's not surprising that for people who were not exposed to more than the old maximum permissible lung burden of 16 nanocuries, that we have there are very few cases, if any, that I know of. Now, I just threw this in at the end because we've been talking about strontium, and this is really just an afterthought here. For our strontium cases at Davis, we had 4 different kinds of cancer being produced by strontium in the skeleton. Bone sarcoma, we had periodontal carcinomas, the base of the teeth. We had oral nasal carcinomas from the bones in the nasal area, and radiation from the teeth. The dogs were exposed beginning at mid-gestation and until about 540 days of age. And so consequently, their teeth were uniformly labeled with strontium 90. It's quite interesting, actually. You could take their teeth at death and measure it. It was essentially the same concentration as when the teeth were formed. So we have this 4 different kinds of cancer produced. And I just plotted it versus the groups. We had 7 dose groups. These dogs were fed strontium 90 in your food. You heard the story before. Marv talked about it. And here's the corrected observed over expected ratio. I did a PETA, what's called a PETA analysis of these rates. Now, in the controls, there were 2 fatal bone sarcomas and 2 incidentals. There were 4 cases among 162 dogs. In the 3 lowest dose groups, there were no bone sarcomas, fatal or otherwise, none at all, among 183 dogs. and I did a statistical test of that, and basically the P is 0.047. So what we've got here is an observation that the incidence of bone sarcoma in our three lowest dose groups is statistically lower than what we observed in the controls. And that's something we discussed. Then we have the point where we get to about, and this is about, you know, between 10, below 10 gray. Below 10 gray, there just weren't any cases. Then you get above 10 gray, and you see all these different kinds of cancers appearing. A threshold-like result. All of this information is in the paper that I published in March in the Health Physics Journal. And I have extra copies if you didn't get one. And that's all. Oh, that's my last slide. You'll notice my... Questions?
Going back to your plutonium human, you know, scaled.
Yes.
Your sort of practical threshold there would be up, what, somewhere around 150 nanocuries?
Well, if you allow me, I'll look up the exact number. It's the important thing about the actinides, as you realize, is the way they distribute in the bone. And the plutonium goes to the bone marrow. So the dose to the bone marrow is probably around about 10 sieverts, about the same as...
Okay.
Let me look it up for you, though. So what I've got here, for cumulative doses below about 1 gray or 20 sieverts delivered to the sensitive tissue, that would be to the... actual to the cells at the surface of the bone, the cells at the bone surfaces, it's about 1 gray or 20 sieverts. That's what I call a threshold, okay. A virtual threshold.
Yeah.
I don't call it a practical threshold. That's the terminology that Bob Evans used.
Yeah.
But I like to call it a virtual threshold, recognizing that it's not a real threshold. In fact, if you look at the plots, the radiation is getting more effective. And, you know, I explained how it took 1/10 as much radiation to cause cancer at the lower dose rate. The radiation is getting more effective. And the reason there's a virtual threshold is because the lifespan of individuals is limited. Yeah. And I always say that if, you know, medical science extends human life, then we have to move the standards down. So that 10 sieverts is about the same for both the alpha and the beta, but to the sensitive tissues. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that when you look at the relative potency of the different radionuclides, it depends the way in which the sensitive tissues are being irradiated. So in the case of the skeleton, it's a question of how much of the dose is delivered to the cells at the bone surfaces. And, for example, I mentioned the radium-228. The radium-226 behaves like calcium, moves into the bone quite uniformly, radiates the whole skeleton pretty well, except for the bone marrow. And so that's the one model that gives us the baseline. Now, for radium-228, it's a beta emitter. It goes into the bone uniformly with the calcium, and goes through two beta decays and comes out thorium-228. When the bone is being remodeled, and the bone is being remodeled all the time, the thorium is released from the bone, and it doesn't go back into the bone because it doesn't behave like calcium anymore. It ends up at the bone surfaces. It gets in the cells. It actually gets in the cells. So the thorium is moved from the skeleton, where it's not doing much damage because it's an inanimate bone primarily, to the cells at the bone surfaces. And the consequence is that the radium-228 is 2.7 times in the Beagle studies, 2.7 times more effective than the radium-226. And that comes from the data from Utah. And so you can look at all the different radionuclides that I have in my paper and come up with what I call a potency. And that really depends on how well the sensitive cells are radiated. Now, for the lung, it's just the opposite. It's pretty clear that the more uniformly the lung is irradiated, the higher, the more potent the radiation is in producing lung cancer. So, for example, the winner is the plutonium-239 nitrate, one of the two, that spreads out quite uniformly, the highest potency for lung. Plutonium-239 nitrate studies from PNL. They were the most potent for plutonium-239. Because in that case, the material went in, some momentarily soluble, so to speak, quickly oxidized. Solubility product constant for plutonium is 10 to the minus 52. So there are no ions left in the lung after just a few moments, but it's spread out. It's spread out. And that's the most effective way to get lung cancer, spread it out. And then among all the different studies, you get different the rates of this depending upon how the cells are being irradiated. So the potency varies for different studies, different radionuclides, different studies, different particle size distributions, whatever changes the way the cells are being irradiated. And in my paper, I list all those ratios. Now let's see, who's next? Question? Scott?
Back to talking about extrapolating the doggy studies to the human studies, that the skeleton, of course, is made up of 200-plus bones, each of which is anatomically and metabolically different. And we know, of course, that plutonium has its own profile of tumor distribution, as does radium in the Beagle skeleton. And what we did with the Russians a few years ago is we finally had enough cancers in the Russian population that were putative plutonium cancers to make that comparison, whereas we have maybe one cancer in the U.S., maybe two, but one that we think is strongly associated with plutonium in the human. And when you compare the distribution of naturally occurring tumors to plutonium tumors in the Beagle dog and in humans with the MIAC workers, we have about 30 bone cancers. I couldn't have made up the data. It almost is right down to a couple of percent. The plutonium tumors typically occur in the high turnover site in the axial skeleton, the spine, whereas radium tumors and naturally occurring tumors, radium tumors typically occur in cortical bone, peripheral bones, and then naturally occurring osteosarcomas occur in younger people, mostly in the leg bones, with the exception of one rare disease, and that's called Paget's disease in the spine. And we were working with a Russian pathologist, and we went through all the cases in the MIAC workers to exclude that. So it was really convinced me that our Beagle studies are very predictive of the humans and vice versa with the skeletal cancers.
It would be very interesting to do a lifespan normalization on the Beagle data and see how well it predicts what you observed.
Right.
I can send you that plot. I've got the plot. I just don't have any points on it.
Right. We published that in Radiation Research in 2005.
The data?
And we'd like to update it. The sidelight of that story is many, many years ago, I received a phone call out of the blue from the former director of the USTUR, who I think we all know. And he said, I think we have a human plutonium tumor. It'd be the first one in the United States. But he said, it's in a very unusual location in the body. And I said, don't tell me, let me guess. And I said, I'll bet it's in the lower spine, based upon our doggy studies. And he literally didn't answer the phone and said, well, thanks for telling me, and click. And I knew I nailed it. You're right. So.
Any more questions? I guess Dan has a little program you want. Oh, is there another question?
No, weren't you going to? Somebody else was ahead of me.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, okay.
But while he's waiting, one of the things we did with the Beagles early on at the beginning of nuclear medicine was to use fluorine-18 to determine what the Beagle skeleton was doing in terms of remodeling. The fluorine, of course, would go to the parts of the skeleton that were remodeling most rapidly. And interestingly, that map is identical to the map of where the bone tumors later arise. And it was done, that was done in 1970 with Hal Anger at Berkeley.
Well, I'm primarily been in radiation protection for 35 years. I know that doesn't impress anybody in this room, but of the people still working full time in the group I'm in, I'm one of the old guys. So I had a couple of things I wanted to say in general, and this is mostly for, or some of this is for the younger people, but. Let's see if this works. That's not it. Next slide. That's right. That's my computer. So this is a slide that I showed at the health physics meeting just a month or so ago. In radiological health, everyone is somebody's customer. And I just modified the slide so it looks like I was talking about you guys. So next slide, please. When we do any kind of studies, I think that the goal should be to express our understanding of the health effects of ionizing radiation. And originally I made these couple of slides for radiation epidemiology, which is where I'm working with Scott Miller on the MIAC worker studies. We're doing dose reconstruction for the epidemiologists. So we'd like to express our understanding comprehensively in a common language that is suitable for science and healthcare, for radiation protection. Of course, I've got a lot of bullets there, not only for standard setting, but for design and engineering, for assessment of regulatory compliance, and worker counseling. So in radiation protection, they've come up with an absolute nightmare list of dose quantities that are used that continue to evolve and change. And then, of course, for worker counseling, when a worker is concerned, she comes to you and says, well, I'm worried about starting a family and I just got, you know, inhaled some plutonium. What do you tell that worker? This is a very real human problem. And your answer to that has to be based on somewhat on science, because you're now outside of the regulatory sphere. We also have environmental protection considerations. So it's not only people that we're concerned about. We are concerned about protecting beagles and bugs and bunnies and everything else in the environment. And finally, there's this question of litigation. And I'm not saying that we should go to work in the morning thinking we're going to support lawyers, but in fact, many of you have engaged in expert testimony. So next slide. So you're going to need to punch the button a lot here. Hit the first one. So if you start with an experiment, the customer for that experiment maybe somebody who's going to do dose reconstruction. A lot of you think of dose reconstruction as part of the experiment you've done, and certainly there's been a lot of credible work presented. Next, the next step is you turn over your health outcomes and your doses to somebody who does analysis. It could be a biostatistician guided by a biologist or by an epidemiologist, but typically now it's biostatisticians that do this. Next. And what we've discovered in radiation epidemiology for people is that this is an iterative process. We bring them a rock, they don't like it. We bring them another rock, they don't like it. We bring them another rock, and we finally figured out that this is full employment until we retire, which is what we're doing with MIAC. I mean, this is going to be soon the third edition of the dosimeter, or the fourth edition for the dosimetry for MIAC is going to come out, and we're well into working on the fifth edition, which will take me past my 65th birthday. Anyway, from here we go to risk assessment bodies. And this is where I don't think when you guys got up in the morning in 1950 and said, I'm going to design a Beagle experiment, that you were thinking that, oh, ICRP is going to be looking at these data 60 years from now, or UNSCEAR. So the National Academies, the Beer Committees, for example, they all have to take the work that's done from radiation biology studies as well as radiation epidemiology and use it. And if we have calculated doses that do not generalize well to doses that we're interested in for humans, we have not produced a product that's really considering this customer. If we have not measured tissues that seem to be of interest, we're not serving this customer. So, for example, we just submitted three papers on doses to U.S. residents from internal radioactive materials, excluding medical diagnosis, and also excluding radon, for which there is no bioassay. So we are really looking at potassium-40, uranium series, thorium series, the Neptune, anyway, the U-235 series, rubidium-87, carbon-14, and tritium. There really isn't any data. There are no data left on strontium-90 in human beings. There isn't anything that's less than about 35 years old. The same for I-129. There's nothing, and no human data that we were able to locate that is relevant to today. So we looked at these, and we were trying to match up the measurements that have been made at, for example, at University of Utah. There was a lot of data we got from the literature from Utah. And not anywhere, except maybe a couple of things I think we got from Tony James and the USTUR, nobody ever measured esophagus, right? Nobody for uranium or thorium, and we can make up a K40 number. And so who knew that we were going to need doses to esophagus? But that's 4% of the effective dose that NCRP and ICRP want to talk about. And there's simply no data. The data for other things are incredibly sparse. In reviewing human measurements of these radionuclides, it is purely lamppost effect, meaning you were looking where the light was. So where'd you look? You looked at lung, you looked at liver, you looked at bone. That describes like 95% of the numbers that are out there. And then, so we had to, in order to come up with effective doses, the radiation protection kind of doses, we had to impute, that is a nice word for making up numbers, we had to impute tissue concentrations in all the other tissues on the ICRP list. Well, the ICRP list didn't even, they weren't even the same from 1977 to the 1990 recommendations to the 2007 recommendations. Furthermore, when you look at list, we have two things, bone surfaces and bone volume, that we want to calculate dose to, right? And so from Tony James, we get 400 bones and marrow. And so we have enormous quantities of bone data. And we have to then re-aggregate those into something like bone surfaces and bone volume. And it's actually not, in many cases, you can't do it. We couldn't figure out what the uncertainty was. The earlier the paper, the less useful the uncertainty information was. We could not disaggregate uncertainty from variability, right? You measure 10 beagles, you've got 10 different numbers. Part of the difference between those numbers is your measurement uncertainty. The other part is real variability. If you made perfect measurements, that variability would still be there, and you'd have no uncertainty. You'd still have a standard deviation because some beagles have more, some beagles have less. Well, we were unable to disaggregate population variability from measurement uncertainty in many cases. We're working on doing that right now. Go ahead, next slide. There are radiation protection recommending bodies. In the case of the ICRP, it's the same thing. They do both. But in other cases like EPA, they make up their own numbers. And by the way, EPA doesn't use dose. Anybody hear me? EPA does not use dose. They use risk. So they go from radionuclide concentrations in the environment all the way to 10 to the minus umpty ump lifetime fatal cancer incidence or lifetime cancer incidence. Why does EPA not use dose? Because you cannot add a dose of radiation to an exposure to chemicals. And EPA is not limited to radiation. So we need to have something that EPA can use as well in our work. The risk management bodies then, so here we get the standards recommended, ICRP, NCRP. You know, the Beer committees don't recommend standards. UNSCEAR doesn't recommend standards. Maybe this is IAEA, where they try and the rubber tries to meet the road. And then we have risk management bodies, EPA, NRC, DOE. There's actually 11 federal agencies involved in radiation risk management. And then you come back to where I started, which is operational radiation protection. And in fact, for epidemiology, this might be where you'd start over and over. And just one more click, and we should have the cycle here. Well, so what happens? You look at the uranium miners or the underground miners in Czechoslovakia, and you see here some kind of an observation, perhaps, of a health effect. And we go around and we say, well, let's invent something we can measure in a uranium mine. That was done. And we went around the cycle for the uranium miners. That actually took longer than it did for the radium dial painters or the early radiologists. And then we started to see medical populations. The ankylosing spondylitics had extra disease. So did the fluoroscopy patients, and then the Oxford Childhood Cancer Study. And every time we got more epidemiology or biology, we went around this cycle again. And if you look at the series of reports from the original Bayer report, Biological Effects of Atomic Radiation, that came out in 1956, and all the recommendations that were made up until that point, you'll see that we've been around this cycle. So the first internal risk assessment and radiation protection recommendation was Robley Evans sitting around a table, I believe, in 1940. Otto can probably tell a story better than I can. And they said, well, we don't see anything at a body burden of 1 microcurie, so let's call it 1/10 of a microcurie, and our wives and daughters would be safe. That was their risk analysis reasoning. Anyway, we've been around this cycle. And it's actually, if I were a good graphic artist, I would turn this into a spiral that advances over time. Because these recommendations have come down and down and down from 1/10 of an erythema dose with Sievert and Mutscheller and Sievert back in the 1900s, now to ALARA and other recommendations. The only dose limit that really has gone up is for heritable ill health. And we have no human data on that. We only have an absence of data in any kind of low doses in animals. So next slide, please. So this is the cycle. From my point of view, we've seen failures in occupational radiation protection, failures in uranium mines, failures to protect early X-ray workers, and so on. And we go through this cycle with all these models. And it's really a spiral forward through time that we go round and round and round. And so we need to bear in mind that this is all going to come back, and the next thing we discover is going to come back and drive the research. So what I'm pleading for, as somebody who's involved with thinking about radiation risks and what kind of standards and what kind of radiation protection we have, is that you think not just, can I get my next grant or can I get this thing published in radiation research, but what can I... how do I fit into the bigger picture? And so I guess that's the point of that thing. Next slide, please. Then I wanted to point out what I think is the future for the Beagle data. The more I've talked and the more I've listened, I made up these slides mostly this morning. And I wanted to say that what I have seen is almost exclusively Stone Age statistics, or at least from sometime in the last millennium. And there are a number of issues that I would like to raise with you. Next slide, please. First, never show me another plot without uncertainty bars. So Otto, wherever you are, that goes for you. The graph that you had with all of the nothing, 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 and then it starts to go up. I want to see at least a Poisson uncertainty on those numbers. And we've seen over and over and over again that this has been done. I had the privilege of working under Chuck Watson's direction with a Beagle study that I believe has yet to be published. It's a plutonium inhalation study. Dick Weller is not here. And I made sure we put uncertainty bars horizontally on the doses and vertically on the health outcomes. When you do that, you realize how little you know. That these things that appear to the untrained eye to be real effects are simply not distinguishable statistically. I did want to point out there's a few words here that I don't know if this... I don't have a laser pointer. Oh, there it is. Well, you got a good one. Thanks, Otto. Oh, he's well equipped. Thank you, sir. I won't point it in your eyes. The word measurand should be in everybody's vocabulary, and certainly if you were born after 1970. The measurand is ISO speak for the unknown true value. This is adopted by our National Institute for Standards and Technology. This is the truth out there that we're trying to get at when we make a measurement. Error is the unknown difference between the measurand and the reported result. So the measurand is unknown, and the error is unknown. So uncertainty, then, is our estimate of the magnitude of this error. It's a quantitative estimate. So you will never get away in my class with talking about error bars because you don't know the error. And we were all taught wrong. All of my teachers didn't make this distinction. Well, the distinction has been around in metrology for decades, and it's only just now getting out. Well, the uncertainty, then, is our guess. And the way we get about uncertainties, ISO has covered in great detail. I'd be glad to consult with you. But some things that we mistake for statistics are really just an opinion. The square root of n is the standard deviation of a Poisson distribution is not only a biased number, but it's not a very good number. And so I always thought that was statistics when you were doing that. It's not. It's a type B uncertainty evaluation. So anyway, I want to see uncertainty bars not only on the outcome, but on the doses or whatever you've done, the dose rates, the average dose rates, whatever. Next slide, please. Two, please show me non-parametric dose response curves every time you do something like dose and response. These were introduced by Chomentowski and Keller, the papers in Rad Research. I've got a PDF if you've got a thumb drive. It's been used by Radiation Effects Research Foundation ever since, and in IARC. If you see something from Elizabeth Cardis, you'll see non-parametric fits. And how do you do this? You don't put your doses in bins. So what I'm saying is don't bin your doses. Do it in a continuous fashion. You sort all of your health outcomes by dose. So let's say I'm looking at osteosarcoma in Beagles, right? Each Beagle has got a dose, including the controls. Their dose is the amount of radium that's in the bones of a Beagle when he's eaten dog food and nothing else. And you can figure that out, and it's actually not that much lower than the lower dose ones. Okay. So you sort everybody by dose, and for the background doses, the dose they get is the dose, some fraction of their age, their in years, times the dose rate. Okay. The individual outcomes, one if you got cancer, zero if you didn't. And then you simply do spectrum smoothing. This is an old concept. If you're as old as I am, this was a big thing in the 60s and 70s. And it's simply a rolling average that you run through the data. It's easy to do. I like to use a triangular rolling average where, let's say, I've got, let me take a simple number, like I've got five people. So the dose for the guy in the middle would have a weight of five. And the dose for the people next, would have a weight of three. The dose for people on either side would have a weight of two, and the dose for people that are a little farther out would have a weight of one. You add them up, divide by the sum of the weighting factors, and you've got what you plot at Mr. Number 3. So it's just spectrum smoothing. You could do a Gaussian smooth, you could do triangular, you can do linear, whatever. And I'll show you examples of this. And then this will work for dose response in the histograms that Tony James's people were showing this morning. Don't bend them. Let me see the real thing. The Kaplan-Meier things that we saw from Gale weren't bend at all. They were just continuous. Next slide, please. So here, for example, for solid tumors in lifespan study, you can see the non-parametric fit, okay? And this non-parametric fit, they blow it up and it goes right down here, and it doesn't dip. But, oh, by the way, I'm looking at excess relative risk. This is one of the things I would like to see. I've never seen excess relative risk in a single dog study. I want to know what the relative risk is as a function of age, and I want to see the excess relative risk. Because, after all, that's what you always see for people. Why aren't dogs as good as people? Next slide. These are from Dale Preston. And I wouldn't have error bars, but I'd like uncertainty. And there is no uncertainty on this thing, which is just a calculated thing. So here's a, this is the smooth, is this dash dot thing that kind of snakes through the various fits. And those non-parametric things can be done. Next slide, please. Here's the one for leukemia. And these are the binned data, which seem to be pretty scattered, but when you do this thing, you think, well, maybe there's a trend there. Next slide. Here's one that I did, and I sat at lunch with Otto, and you should never trust your data to a non-biologist like me, because Otto explained the difference between radium-228 and radium-226 doses, and he explained the cancers I should have left out. I just took all the 2,403 lines out of the back of Bob Rowland's book on radium patients, and here's what I did. I figured out how much radium they had in their bones if they were a reference man. And then we had date of birth, date of death. I integrated that dose rate. And every single one of those 2,400 people is a data point on here, on this graph. Because they either got an alpha dose from radium or they got something else. Right? So this is just alpha doses. And if you see, this is Robley-Evans' plot from 0.001. Now this is dose, not dose rate. And it's not a radium burden, it's dose. And it goes up to about 200 grays to the skeleton. It's hard to see here, but the non-parametric fit is this bright green line that kind of snakes through the data. And that's with a bin size of 49 in a triangle. And it's just rolling through the data doing that average, right? So the bright green line is what you get if you don't know anything about a dose-response relationship, right? Now, the difference between this graph and Robley-Evans' graph from 40 years ago or whenever that was, is simply that I heard about Chomentowski and Keller's data smoothing. I'm not, you know, I haven't added anything here except a way of looking at the data. Then there's two fits here. The purple one is a linear non-threshold, and the yellow one is a linear threshold. Both of these curves also had a maximum dose or a maximum incidence, which it turns out is somewhere around 0.4. Doesn't seem like, regardless of the dose, you can't get more than 40% of the people getting bone cancers. I blew up a couple of things. This is the same graph, identical graph on a linear scale. You have, as Otto pointed out, 1,800 people down here with no radium measurement in them. And then you got this green line that snakes through the data. If you notice, each data point here has got an uncertainty in both directions. So this kind of cloud is telling you how much we really know about these numbers. And the uncertainties were based on a Poisson uncertainty, nothing else. And the dose was based on the range of people for whom we average doses. So this guy here, his dose is actually out there. Now, this is in the region of the threshold. The green thing here is that non-parametric fit, which starts to go up as cancers begin appearing, which happened about 8.9 grays the way I did the dose calculations. Here's the linear fit. Here's the threshold fit. I'm not going to go there, but I'm just saying, come on, show me your data with a non-parametric fit, no dose bins. Next slide, please. Again, this Otto would probably do a much better job than I did, but clearly this is the on a linear scale, this is the linear threshold fit, and this thing is the linear non-threshold. And you say, linear, Dan, that doesn't look linear. Well, I just simply calculated the risk that was associated with the dose of each person. So I've got a linear risk plotted at each individual's dose. And so this is what you would predict with a linear or nonlinear fit. And here's the linear one. And basically, right down here, the linear predicts 12 cases, and you've observed no observed cases below 11 grays in the linear. So that's obviously some kind of a threshold there. Go ahead. Next slide. Bayesian statistics. Everything we're doing in the MIAC worker study, courtesy of Ray Gilmet, Guthrie Miller, and others, is Bayesian. Alan Birchall of the UK Health Protection Authority has incorporated Bayesian inference into the IMBA code, and the Russians are kind of replicating that because they want their own code. But Bayesian inference is a formal way of incorporating everything we know into probabilistic statements about results. So our doses are not going to be a point dose. They're going to be a probability distribution of dose. And those probability distributions are going to be unbelievably wide for the plutonium doses in the MIAC workers. The only thing that has wider dose distributions is the working level month numbers for underground uranium miners, where some of those numbers were based on measurements in other mines. And I would argue you're not within a factor of 50 for one standard deviation either way. Bayesian is widely used for probabilistic risk analysis. It's everything NASA does, everything the Defense Department does. When doing an experiment costs you $100 million, you use Bayesian to figure out ahead of time where you need to look. And it certainly is used for bioassay, inference of dose from bioassay and autopsy, and it's just coming in everywhere. The outcomes are probability density functions. I don't have any to show you, but we're about to submit a manuscript on doing this for measurements that are near background, where some of the measurements are negative, and we wind up with positive probability distributions for everybody. It's a way of dealing with a problem that has come up in epidemiology that the biostatisticians have identified, really beginning in about 2007, that we need to work on. Next slide, please. Uncertainty. Sorry, Scott, if you've seen this, heard me talk about this before, but every single radiation epidemiology study is going to have to be reanalyzed. RERF, every study you've ever seen, to handle shared uncertainty versus unshared, to handle Bergson versus classical uncertainty, and to deal with autocorrelation over time when that's done. I do not exaggerate. Nothing will come out of IARC that doesn't do this, out of Elizabeth Cardis's former shop. Nothing will come out of the National Cancer Institute radiation epidemiology branch that doesn't respect these. And I know that this has been just the nastiest surprise to any epidemiologist you could imagine. Because to deal with the shared uncertainties, this is something where everybody has the same uncertainty, and you say, well, Dan, that's just what we used to call systematic. Yeah, but the effect of a systematic uncertainty a systematic effect on uncertainty is shared. So if everybody here had the same film badge, right? You each had a film badge, and you went in a room and you got various different doses. And you came back out and we looked at your film badge results. And then we determined that the activity of the radium source that was used to calibrate that badge of film badges wasn't known very well. They claimed it was a curie, but maybe it was 0.9 curies, maybe it was 1.1. Well, if it was 1.1, it was 1.1 for every one of you. That kind of uncertainty goes up and down together. It's shared. It's correlation coefficient between the uncertainties here, 1. Correlation matrix, whole half of a matrix full of 1s. How do you deal with that? A technique called two-dimensional or two-stage Monte Carlo, first used for the Hanford environmental dose reconstruction. They never published it, and it's been used now since 2008. Stainer et al. Actually came out December. It published December 2007. That paper was retracted because they got something wrong, but this is what everybody is doing now, is the two-dimensional Monte Carlo. What we're doing for MIAC, we have been asked to give annual absorbed doses for 6 colors of radiation: external gamma, external beta, low LET neutron, high LET neutron, alpha, and medical x-rays. Now, medical x-rays, you'd argue, are the same as external photon, but they're keeping them separate. To each of 18 tissues and organs. Now, I'd like to see the whole ICRP list, but no, we were told this is what you're doing. Annually, for people who might have survived 60 years since their first exposure, for 26,000 people. So that's a lot of numbers. But in order to do this, we have to do that 1,000 times, which is to say our dose product will be about 1.2 terabytes for the MIAC population. Okay? And we're going to give that to the biostatisticians, and they're going to say, you mean I have to run my analysis 1,000 times? And we're going to say, yes. And not only that, you have to save the likelihood function each time. And when you get done, you have to add the likelihoods. And then you'll have a probability distribution of the excess relative risk per gray. And oh, by the way, you have to do that for 6 colors of radiation, and you're controlling for smoking, and you're controlling for sex, and you're controlling for alcohol, and you're looking at DTPA in the case of the internal doses. And that sounds like full employment, doesn't it? If only DOE would fund us adequately. But I get no sympathy for that complaint here. Berkson versus classical. Again, I'd be glad to share this with you. In 1950, Joseph Berkson, MD, published a paper in a medical journal that said, the title was, "Are there two regressions?" Question mark. The answer was unequivocally, yes, there are two regressions. And so there are two types of errors. And when I use that word error, I'm talking about a difference between a true value and the value we're claiming is that this individual has. So this is the unknowable difference. And when you start doing thought experiments, you can talk about errors, because in the thought experiment, you know the truth. And what Berkson said was, there's two kinds of things. Suppose we were to measure everybody's height, and all we had was a stretchy tape measure, and we just didn't get very good values. Okay, that's measurement uncertainty. Some of us are taller in the evening than we are in the morning, or the other way around. And so you get measurement uncertainty. We all understand that. The needle is wiggling on the meter, or the numbers are going up and down. Right? Those are measurement uncertainties. Everything you know about those is still true. But what Berkson pointed out is that when we assign a value to people, when we assign a dose, and we do it to a group, that's a completely different thing. So here's the idea. Let's say we got an X-ray machine, right? And we have 1,000 mice, and we stick them a meter away from the X-ray machine in a little cage, and we turn it on. And we give everybody 1,000 milliamp seconds at 140 kVp with a certain amount of filtration, and we put our dosimeter in there, and we dose that up, and then we assign that dose to every mouse, right? Did they actually get that dose? Well, no. Some of them were fat. Some of them were skinny. Some of them were on this side of the cage. Some of them were farther away on that side of the cage. Oh, by the way, we forgot to check the line voltage compensator every time we shot. If you're old enough to remember those on X-ray machines from the 50s and 60s, it was a real crapshoot what the output was. And we had a mechanical timer, and sometimes it would stick. And instead of a minute, you'd get 2 minutes of exposure or whatever. Well, those uncertainties are called Berkson, or grouping uncertainties. So this is where we've assigned everybody the same value. Well, it turns out there are many, many components of uncertainty, many components. If I treat you all as if you're a reference man, the calculational model that's used for internal doses, that causes Berkson uncertainty. Well, so what? Well, for an individual, for one person, the difference between classical and Berkson is zero. But if you're doing a dose response analysis, the difference is very important and very large. There have been a bunch of really good papers, Stram and Kopecky 2003, and then Schaefer and Gilbert 2006. The latter, I believe, was in radiation research, and that is Ethel Gilbert, the lab fellow emeritus from PNNL, who's at NCI, and Daniel Schaefer of Oregon, Oregon State. And Ken Kopecky's at UW in Seattle. I think you know him, right? Well, they have looked at what happens if you have Berkson and classical uncertainties. What happens to the inference of the excess relative risk per gray. While classical causes bias towards the null, a result that's been around in epidemiology since before I was born. If Berkson values are unbiased, there is very little effect on a linear dose-response relationship. And I don't know if that has a threshold or not. Let's forget that for the moment. But if it's nonlinear, let's say we had a quadratic, then even unbiased Berkson uncertainties make a difference. If the Berkson values are biased, that is, for let's say we have two groups. We've got men and women, but we all call them reference man, right? The difference between women and reference man and men and reference man are different. And we might be completely biased for the women. And we may be really screwing up our dose response analysis. This does matter. The Joseph Berkson paper, by the way, is very readable. If you've got I almost think a high school education, you can understand this thing. It's really amazing. And this really didn't catch on for about 30 years. And then there was a groundswell. And in 1990, there was a paper by Don Pierce and others out of RERF on shared, and they weren't talking about Berkson yet then. There was a much better paper that came out in 2004 that really explained it. I find this stuff rough going, personally. And then finally, we're doing annual doses, which I haven't seen any annual doses or quarterly doses or weekly doses for beagles. But in the people world, we have to have these annual doses. Well, there's also autocorrelation over time. If I'm fat today, I was probably fat 10 years ago. And that means my self-shielding factor, it changes my badge dose into my liver dose differently than it does for a skinny person, right? That's autocorrelation of my uncertainties over time. I'm going to be actually deviating systematically from the pattern. All right, next slide, please. So those uncertainties, it's a big deal. It's never been applied to Beagle data. How about lagging the dose? I haven't heard anybody do this, and I'm just going to go through this. What is the dose that actually causes cancer? Well, remember when it was 2 years up to the diagnosis of leukemia, we figured the dose up until that point because that was the minimum latency seen in the bomb survivors' leukemias. And then it was 10 years or maybe 20 years for solid cancers. Oh, Beer 3 was all up in arms about, you know, what was it in the preceding reports. So if there is some latent period between when that transformed cluster of cells really becomes malignant, if there's some latent period between then and when you diagnose it, that, and by the way, diagnosis is often well before death. So you could put in certainly date of death here or date of diagnosis. So the lag dose is going to be the integral of the dose rate between the time that exposure began and this time, which is the time of diagnosis minus the latent period, which could be a couple of years in people. What's the latent period in beagles for the various kinds of cancers you've discussed? Go. You use 1 year. Okay. All right. And this was for dose. Thank you. That wasn't...
For lung.
For lung. Okay. But you're saying we're counting dose up to 1 year before we diagnosed it. The first time I've heard that, but maybe I don't hear too well. So thank you. So lag the dose. So dose after that time is just wasted. This is dose that's occurring to the organism, and it doesn't matter. In all human epidemiology, they use lag dose. They have for decades. So that would be... Next slide, please. Oh my gosh, I lost my... Somehow or other lost my last slide. Can you go back? I deleted the wrong last slide. There was another slide, and what I wanted to point out in this one is that the lag dose is not proportional to the average dose rate over life. Absolutely not, because when you shorten this average dose rate is going to go up, but the time is going to go down. So dose is not proportional to dose rate unless you have exactly the same time. It's just algebra 1 in high school. The lag dose is also not proportional to the initial lung burden. Why would it be? Some dogs die weeks after getting humongous amounts of radioactive materials. Others live nearly a full lifespan before a tumor appears. So the lag dose is not proportional to the initial lung burden. It's a very rough relationship and can be actually very poor when you have wide ranges of dose. And finally, the lag dose is not proportional to the autopsy tissue burden. The amount, the dose rate that you find at autopsy is not linked to dose unless you've accounted for the time. And then you haven't lagged it for the latency. So I want to see lagged dose. So I could go on, but I'll just stop. I think these are opportunities to make progress on Beagle data. And thank you for your time. I'll be glad to take questions. I can show you slides about Burks and the classical if you want, or otherwise just give up.
So, Dan, I have to comment on the first part of your talk. You know, I heard Otto's presentation, which I thought was great. I heard Tony Brooks talk about this, and there's all these apparent virtual thresholds and things. So how do we come up with these all these risk assessment bodies? Like, let's take BS7 that's got really smart people on it that presumably has had access to all this data. How do we come up with these LNT-type concepts?
Well, I could show you that...
The
slide
version
of solid tumors in the bomb survivors is how we come up with it. And you come, I mean, the arguments are in Beer 7 are laid out that if you, and this ignores, it ignores bystander effects that Tony has talked about. And
I don't think it does. I think bystander effects are already built in.
But anyway, if you just look at the solid tumors and you look at that non-parametric fit, I don't know how you can argue. I mean, that's where they're starting from. But they come up with this theory that the probability of cancer is going to be proportional to the probability of damage to DNA, and that, you know, that theory is not the soundest theory in the world, but it's one of the things that does seem to be linear is mutations and even genetic effects. I mean, wasn't it the paper in, was it Mueller in 1927 that did the fruit fly original paper and said, looks linear to me? So there are some reasons for thinking it's linear. But one of the things that, I mean, any of you could probably give this lecture better than me, but what about the repair and the error correction? It's one thing to repair damage. It's another thing to just have apoptosis that removes a damaged or altered cell. We don't really know those effects. For example, in the absence of heritable ill health observations in human beings, could be explained that there's just simply failure to implant. You never detected the pregnancy. And that's humanity's way of coping with egregious damage. Now, I'm told by the OBGYN crowd that there's four conceptions for every three implantations in human beings. That's a tremendous, either you could say that's a tremendous failure rate or it's a tremendous error correction rate. I actually think it's probably the latter. It's these weren't going to be viable, and so somehow or other the cells figured that out. So, but how you wind up with linear non-threshold in a risk assessment body is a scientific question. How you wind up with linear non-threshold in radiation protection is a no-brainer. And that is, it allows you to add dose from one year to another. Among other things, people would argue it's worked. Other people would argue it's just way too expensive to protect to that level. But the people who make those arguments ignore things like susceptible subpopulations. You know, David Brenner has suggested that all of the cancers you see in the, let's say, the bomb survivors, you've at higher doses, you've simply saturated all the people who could get cancer from radiation, and the rest of them won't. I mean, at those kinds of doses. Now, at the doses that Tony Brooks told us about of 200 grays, you have overwhelmed all kinds of repair mechanisms that might be working at 2 grays. I'm not a biologist, so. Well,
in that case. cases, it seems like a good time to take a break. Let's start again at quarter to four. And over to you, Ben.
Fine. I noticed that you and I are probably in the South Pacific at the same time.